ESPN LA 710.
Hey, Travis Rogers here. When you're not listening to me on the Lakers pre- and post-game shows, tune in to The Experience with LaFern Cusack, where she goes beyond the play and focuses on athletes, fans, and the biggest events that inspire and shape our community. Listen to The Experience with LaFern Cusack Sundays 5 to 6 a.m.
ESPN LA 710.
Welcome to The Experience here on ESPN LA. I'm LaFern Cusack. Thank you so much for joining me. Today, we're talking the Tao of Daddying, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Fathers, with actor, artist, and author Gregory Sporleder. And you, I'm sure you've seen him in playing military men in such films like The Rock, Black Hawk Down, Renaissance Man, and True Blood, which I really admired your effervescence in that in that show.
I had effervescence in that
you
one?
You had effervescence.
Ooh, I got to put that on my resume. I forgot to. That's one of my special skills, I guess.
Yes.
If you say I got it, I must have it.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank
yes.
You,
I was like, oh my goodness, is that Gregory Spoony, Spore Leader. So I call you Spoony.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Most people do. That's
okay.
All right.
Okay. I'm just giving it all away.
Give it, sister. You got it to give.
Now, Gregory, you are going to be doing a book signing, and this is a great book for Father's Day, this coming Saturday, June 9th in Calabasas, Peddler's Fork.
Great place.
Yeah.
Really wonderful place.
And you're going to be interviewed by moi, LaFern Cusack.
Another great person, place, thing. It's going to be exciting.
And we're going to be talking about your book, The Tao of Daddying, Ancient Wisdoms for Modern Fathers. But before we get into all of that, and everybody can go, again, 10 to 12 next Saturday, June 9th at Peddler's Fork in Calabasas. Gregory, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you were or are a huge Chicago Bulls fan, yes?
You know, I must admit I was. I mean, the biggest. Let me just say.
And the word was is key.
Only because there's great, I mean, things will be as great, but nothing will be greater than Jordan and Pippen and that crew that won those six titles. And so I thought, since I'd seen greatness, I would move on to something else. Because I have a, you know, I don't have the biggest of brains, so I can only have so much intake. And I thought, well, that'll be my basketball file for life. No one knows more about Jordan and Pippen and that whole period than I do. But I'm sure some people know as much. But man, I really, really loved that whole era.
What did you love about it? what are your top moments?
Well, I would say that they made it feel so accessible to be great. You know, it was before the internet, so you had to read the papers and you had to watch interviews. And of course, I was involved with theater at the time, which is a lot, you know, like, essentially, we were all failed sports addicts doing crazy theaters. And so it was so great to just see Jordan just keep evolving and Phil Jackson evolving his play. It was just really I was at that age, too, where it was after college time. And as a young adult, you need to keep learning. And so it was a really great way to evolve along with those guys.
Yes.
Wonderful.
And it's amazing how they were able to evolve in different ways to earn those six titles. I just remember, I think it was the third one, and I was there, and everybody was taking the train downtown for the parade, and the energy was amazing.
Well, I used to wait tables constantly, and you would get on the bus, and you could have a conversation with every single person on
yeah.
the bus during basketball season, from old lady to young child. Everyone knew what was happening. Everyone was so proud and excited. It was really a wonderful time. And you know, it almost like ESPN should be called Michael Jordan because there wasn't enough highlights. You'd watch the news before ESPN. You'd watch the news, and they'd only show like one clip. Whereas, you know, Mike had at least seven or eight, and that's then you had Horace Grant, then you had everyone else because he made everyone else so much better and much more exciting as well. So ESPN, I'm pretty sure, was evolved out of, we need more to see Jordan the Bulls, and
yes.
That kind of evolved at the same time, I remember.
So
it was cool.
So your love for the sport and how you see the sport, how did you incorporate that into your life?
Well, to push. just to always be better. I remember when Jordan came in, well, he got hurt that first season, and he persevered through that. And then he wasn't – there's the famous story where he was in the elevator with and Magic Johnson, and those guys boxed him out of the All-Star game, and he didn't take that – he just kept persevering. Mm-hmm. And then they said he wasn't a defensive player. Then he became Defensive Player of the Year. And so, you know, as a young man watching that, thinking – I also remember this story about how he arrived in Chicago at the airport, and the Bulls driver wasn't there for him. Oh. And this young man said, "Do you need a ride?" And he was a young limo driver, and it was Jordan's personal driver and assistant
from
that point on. Yeah, Jordan and him just. And so I remember those little things, and that Jordan came from, you know, humble beginnings and had a great mom and dad, and his big brother Larry was a big influence. And then what he did for, you know, Phil convinced him that he had to pass, that he had to be a team player. And then I also love Scottie Pippen just as much. And to watch Scottie evolve was really inspiring as well, to say, you know, because I was hanging around some pretty awesome, spectacular people myself and thought, you know what, number two, there is no number two if number one and two work together, you know.
Exactly.
So it was great.
Exactly. And that's what I love about the game. It's just like, you know, you can have your star players, of course, but it takes a village.
The whole team.
It takes the whole team.
I tell you, you know, and I stopped watching basketball for a while, but now what's going on, it's impossible. Well, and Steve Kerr, who people stop me on the street, they think I'm...
Oh my gosh, yes, right.
Steve Kerr. I'll play them the Steve Kerr story. And so that's an extension. So it's really fun. I do watch some now, and seeing that, and what a great guy he is, and how he's exposing his personality and his beliefs into the mainstream is really cool.
Exactly.
Too. I love Steve.
I have a Michael Jordan story. Can I share?
Please do.
Okay, so as an actor in Chicago, darling, I got on a commercial with him for Hanes.
Hey.
And we shot up in, I don't know, one of those, you know, Juliet or, you know, those.
Suburbs.
Schaumburg. Mm-hmm. I think it was Schaumburg on a mansion and you know, you just see me walking in the background but he was so awesome. Right.
Yeah.
And then the very next day he came to the play at the Goodman Theater that I was in.
Oh, no kidding.
And I was like,
wow,
backstage with him. I was like, oh, Mr. Jordan. I was like, I was on the set with you yesterday at the Hanes commercial. Nice. He goes, oh, how did the rest of the shoot go? I was like, oh, it was great. You know, it was nice, you know, nice meeting you. It's like, nice meeting you. You know, it was so awesome. I was like shaking.
I'm shaking just hearing that story.
Riveting.
He really was a magical person. You know, it was so humble and yet so fierce all at the same time. It really made for some compelling time.
Now, you grew up in St. Louis, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And you had a really interesting childhood. And if you, like, we were talking the other day and you said, if anybody would tell me if I could write a book or be in a movie, you said you would never pick writing a book. You would pick. I'm most likely going to be in a movie. Can you tell us about that?
Well, first, how lucky am I to have done both? And that goes back to that evolving thing, right?
Yes.
You know, had I thought the things that I believed and sort of told I was as a kid, because, you know, I'm extremely dyslexic, and I was dyslexic back when they used to just call it stupid. So before they really knew what it was, and so that was really hard for, you know, people with brains like mine to memorize that sort of information. I also grew up as a minority in a place called University City, Missouri, which is just on the outskirts of the city line. I grew up with black folks, and so I was a dyslexic minority, skinny white boy coming up, you know. And so it was an amazing, it set me up to be a great, not a great actor, but an actor, you know, being so observant and watching people. And fit in, trying to fit in, find ways to, and then of course I learned to dance So
what?
Yeah, so I could. That's how I fit in. You know, I wasn't fast enough or talented enough as an athlete. So I thought, well, if I'm ever gonna get any girls or friends, I better. What could I do? And so I'd stay at home and watch Soul Train. You know,
yes.
Before VCRs, you know, you only had that 1 hour to watch it. You know, and the Soul Train line would come on. I remember when Walter Payton was on it. Get my groove on.
Oh,
so so that like showing off like that and trying to fit in is how I started. And so but again, you know, I didn't take to writing and reading until I got out of college, and the pressure was off.
Mm-hmm.
And then I began to say, well, I taught myself to read and love reading, and then I finally said, you know, I'm going to try to figure out how to start writing too, because I love reading so much. I wonder if I could do it. And so that's how it started.
So when you say dyslexic, you're dyslexic, how did you get through school? How did you maneuver? I mean, you're talking about adapting in a situation, in a social situation where you're adapt or die, you know, and you did.
Well, I have to admit it was two things. One was it was before Reagan cut all the arts out of the public schools. So all through high school, I played a trumpet, danced during school and after school. I did ceramics. I did painting. I did art history.
Wow.
And then I did just enough academics to get through. Nowadays, you couldn't do it. Like, I didn't take a foreign language. I took one math class and got all D's. I mean, the day they put numbers and letters together, I thought I was going to just go crazy.
Wait, so when you see numbers, are numbers flipped as well?
Well, that's the most obvious way. Dyslexia is really about memorizing. And so since spelling is not logical, it doesn't make sense. It's so hard to memorize. So you have to just solely memorize but the look of words. Math is different because the numbers are there, and that's when they start to flip around. In turn, you know, you see them differently. So to line them all up is rough.
Oh,
so
okay.
When you really learn about, and then each person has a different, you know, it also has to, dyslexia also has to do with pronouncing things and sort of hearing things as well.
Right.
So it's pretty specific to the type of, you know, the brain that you have and the situation that you're in. So I was stimulated by all these arts.
Mm-hmm.
But when you handed me that trumpet and the music got harder, watching those little notes on those little lines, I just couldn't. It was just impossible for my brain and fingers to match up. But I could feel the music in me.
Oh, yeah.
And so that's when I said, I feel this music I love. And I love music as much as anyone could love music. And I just said, well, I'm going to bring the music alive in my body. And that's how I became a dancer.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm one of the few white people who can say they've danced on Soul Train. There, I said it.
You did?
Yeah. This hand shook the great Don Cornelius' hand.
Why isn't that in your bio?
Well, I keep it secret. I wait for the special moment. But it was really a great moment. And so that was one of those things, you know, had I believed all the things the teacher said and what my grades said and kind of what I felt about myself, I wouldn't have been able to evolve. And so I hope to encourage people, and that's what this book is about too, is encouraging daddies to say, you know, listen, the odds can be stacked against you.
Mm-hmm.
And the odds are kind of stacked against daddies nowadays. It's really it's really a tough gig. And so that's what I hope to do, because
mm-hmm.
I've sort of lived it myself in several ways. That's kind of how I get my motor apparatus, if that's what they
right,
call it.
Right. Effervescence.
I think I blew that part, sorry.
The Tao of Dadding, which is now on Amazon. Please
yes.
go there, check it out. And
you know what? I think there's a couple of dyslexic. I just found a couple typos.
That's all
but
right.
But don't hold it against me.
No.
I almost put a dyslexic disclaimer in the back. And you know what? You're going to start seeing that. I know this guy who did a TED Talk. He's extremely dyslexic as well, and he started a foundation up in Boston. And I was so impressed with his TED Talk that I sent him an email, and we began talking, emailing. And I noticed at the bottom of his email, he had this disclaimer saying, you know, there might be mistakes in my email because my eyes just can't see
right.
can't see them.
Yeah, because what is it, the English police on like Twitter and social media?
Yeah,
that's rough.
God bless them. You know, it's just so easy to. It's hard for people to understand who can't, you know, but people like me just can't see it. You know, we try our hardest.
So you were in again, movies like The Rock, Black Hawk Down, how did you memorize your lines? Like,
well, that's easy because you're pretending, you're playing, it's a game. You know, you're doing. Whereas learning is, you know, you're essentially memorizing. So to memorize lines was all I had to do was say, well, of course, repetition. But I was interacting, and it was part of a play. People were going to be watching. I was going to get to show off in a way. That the energy of live performance is, the first time I did it, I just said, whatever it takes to do more of this is so fun. And also because I liked watching it. I liked watching it as much as I did, mm-hmm. you know, performing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, one way or another, I'm obviously going to be watching this as long as I live. With theater and performance.
Right.
And man, I want to see if I can't get up on there as well, so.
Right. So one thing that you were talking about, the feeling of it, that's, like, in my communication, like, growing up, I was a feeler,
yeah.
Gregory. I was a feeler.
Yeah.
And, you know, words, you know, it didn't come easy for me or anything, but I don't know. Like, when I got into college, they say, okay, we're going to have, you know, the finals. Here are 7 topics for essays that might be on the test, right? So I would pick out 3, totally write the essay, memorize all 3.
Wow.
And then
hope
that one of those 3 were going to be on the test. Is that what was similar to what you did? Or?
No, what I would do is I would call in sick, and then I would find whatever girl who I could sweet talk into giving me her paper. And the other thing that I did a lot of, and I hate to say it, but it's how I got by, was cheat. I did a lot of cheating. And eventually, I didn't graduate college. I went to acting college, and it was there that it was just clear that I wasn't doing what was sort of required, that I was avoiding, I was cheating, I was plagiarizing, and I wasn't committing to it. And what, you know, nowadays people could say, you know, I'm dyslexic, I need to do it another way.
Mm-hmm.
Back then it was right or wrong, and if you were wrong, you were out. And so I got asked to leave.
Oh,
I was a great actor, but I was a horrible student because I just couldn't. I couldn't write college papers. I couldn't.
Right.
But again, it didn't stop me eventually from learning because, man, now I wish I could get paid to just read and write as well. Because
and you haven't stopped reading. And you started reading at 20. Is that correct?
Well, I started enjoying reading because once the pressure was off, you know, everything up until that point, you had to read for a purpose. You had to take a test, right? So that was more memorizing. And, oh, to be called on to read in class was like, I'd rather just have my own teeth pulled out, you know?
Yeah.
But eventually it was that, you know, 1 or 2 books. Actually, it was your sister-in-law, Ann Cusack, who gave me Salinger's book, and it was Franny and Zoe. And that was one of the brothers, he's an actor, and the girl's having a nervous breakdown, and there's a little book involved. It was very spiritual. And that was the first book that... I went out and got all his other books, and that was the first time I thought, my God, what an incredible world this is.
Mm.
Fiction, and I'm a huge Salinger fan, thanks to your sister-in-law, Anne.
Yay. So you got on stage, and then you also did New Crime Productions in Chicago with my husband.
Yeah.
And talk about that style of art and how you...
Wow, that's a great question, and I hope I don't sound indulgent, but I'm going to tie it back into, you know, if you commit to something that is in your heart that you love, regardless of where it might lead you or what it might pay or if it doesn't pay anything, you know, if you commit long enough and you commit your heart and your soul to it, it will be paid off. I'm getting shivers just thinking about it because what your husband and I did some things on stage that were beyond my wildest dreams, like... You know, that I didn't even know something like that existed. So in college, I had this intense amount of energy. I was young and vibrant, and I always got assigned the death scenes. I was like, oh my God, I got to die again. I don't want to be the old man dying again. They were like, you must learn your... I was like, oh, geez. So I died like 9 times, at least in college, on stage. And so when New Crime came around, here was this form of ancient commedia that started here in L.A. with Tim Robbins' group, The Actors Gang. John Cusack and Jeremy Piven came to L.A. and learned this style. And John created a group in Chicago, which Bill and me and some of those incredible, not only artists, but people I've ever known, gathered and started to learn this form. And so here was a form where there wasn't, you couldn't have enough energy. You couldn't have enough physicality. All the things that they were holding me down in college, here was an art form that said, no, we need more. Now, you have to contain it, and it has to translate for the audience, but no, more, please. And so there it was, like, you know, being, you know, having died all those times in college and being held back in a way, saying, no, I'm going to persevere. I think there's more to this. The reward was, wow, here's an art form I knew nothing about, and it's provided me with such joy that not only did I get to experience, but the things that you know, the audience who would come see our shows, they were always so excited, and it was a real event. It was like punk rock meets theater meets, you know, like the wild circus.
Yeah.
So it was great.
So with that, you have how many main characters in Comedia?
Well, you know, there's like seven. So it's like...
So it's a basketball team.
Yeah, almost a basketball. Well, it is like a basketball team, and then everyone has a role. So each, when a character comes on stage, you recognize sort of who he is, what type of character he is, you know. So, although nowadays a point guard can be, you know, 7 foot tall. Back in the day, they were always the short guy. So it's changing in basketball. But Comedia, it's been around for, you know, a couple hundred years, and pretty much when... You know, your husband, he was great at playing, like, the bossy, what we call the Capitano, who is like Donald Trump, you know, who was very bossy and very demanding, but with a little baby child, and he was very scared, you know. So it was really a wonderful experience in my life, and again, something that I had no idea existed in the world. And because of my commitment and love to stick with acting and artist and being an artist, suddenly, voila, there it was. And as cool as the art form was, the people involved as well was really a great
time. So how did you take that and then come to L.A. and translate that into your film career here?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I probably, sometimes I think the Comedia might have done more, as much harm as it did good, because I'm constantly being told to calm down. Because, you know,
because it's big, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's really big and energetic. And I'm kind of that way in real life. And when I'm told on in a movie or on television to calm down, I'm like, listen, this is me normally. Okay, this is how some people are. And I'm here to represent those energetic, lively people.
Right.
Although, you know, Jeremy Piven, who was part of the group as well, he was a master of Comedia, but he was able to tone it down enough to then bring the comedy right in a way that just touches millions. And so I haven't quite mastered comedy on film yet, but I have a feeling if I can live to be really old, I'm going to be a really funny old actor.
I know. I was talking about that as well. My mother, she was Jamaican, and Jamaicans are really big, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm a Fern, calm it down. It's like, okay, you try being raised by a Jamaican mom.
You know?
What a rascal lad. Ain't nothing gonna bring me down, you know?
You know, I'm alive and direct. Calm down.
Right. So with that journey, okay, coming to L.A., going through... Wait, were you married when you came to L.A.?
No, I wasn't. What was really interesting, and it ties back into this, into the Tao, which as I moved to LA and started to have success, and I was really blessed, because a lot of our tribe from Chicago had already come west, and so I had friends and places to stay until I got established, and a car to borrow until I could buy a car and get set up, and things started to really, really happen. And I was having some great success and so happy and grateful. And things were really taking off when, for my 29th birthday, someone gave me a present, and it was a book called The Tao Te Ching. And it was Stephen Mitchell's translation of the ancient Chinese philosophy. And I opened it up and I thought, wow, I've never really heard of this. It's so interesting. And so I took it home that night, and the and the sweet person who gave it to me said, "Oh, I hear this is, you know, such a great book, and I think you're going to really like it." And took it home and was so utterly fascinated and blown away by these 81 verses or chapters or poems or whatever they're called, many different things, that I just couldn't believe it. It was almost like hearing music for the first time. Or it was almost like, you know, it was like a treasure. It was like a treasure map, but the treasure was inside of me, you know? So it was so magic. And I had a job, and I was going to Atlanta to do this job, and the only book I took was this Tao Te Ching, because I thought, well, I'm just going to really focus on this book. And this was around the same time I was running. I've run 7 marathons, and I'm a really committed runner. And I realized all around the same time that a lot of things that I was doing in my life were exactly what was sort of written in this ancient Chinese philosophy, you know, how to take care of yourself, how to be humble, how to you know, listen to your heart and be a part of nature. And so it was really, it was almost like it was describing my life in another way.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about the philosophy of the Tao is the very first concept is the Tao that can be told is not the true Tao, essentially saying, you know, just live it, don't talk about it. Those that know, don't know. Those that know, don't say. And so for years and years, I just would meditate and read. And, you know, when I woke up, I'd read a passage. When I went to bed, I'd read a passage. And this whole inner world grew inside of me. I'm a very imaginative, creative person as well. And so, and then as I started to get into yoga and meditation, I realized that, yeah, you can receive instruction, but as long as you're not hurting anyone, you can make things your own.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began to make meditation my own. I began to adapt the Tao to my life instead of saying I have to change my life to fit something, which I think is what happens in religion. Like, I don't want to say anything negative about religion, but I was never religious at all, although I envied people that were so committed to mm-hmm. their faith, desired it. In fact, I think that's a primal instinct in all people. And the Tao is a philosophy. Oh, there is a religious aspect to the Tao. I know nothing about. I don't claim to know anything about. I am a practitioner of the philosophy of the Tao. And so that lived inside of me for years and years. And I am married to a wonderful wife, Megan. And she loves the Tao as well. And so then we had a baby. And then we had another baby. And so now I got two babies, and my wife, she had started a business, a clothing business, and it took off like wildfire. It's called Om Girl.
And, for yoga, right?
Yeah, yoga Om. inspired casual wear.
Is it called Om Girl, or is it called Om Girl?
Om. Om Girl.
Om.
Yeah, there's different variations.
Om Girl.
Depending on what time of day you're wearing it.
Om Girl.
And so the business started to really take off, and we had these two little babies. And so we decided it'd probably be best for me just to stop auditioning for a while, because we couldn't stop this business. It was really taking off.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I could always audition at any time as long as I kept my manager and agent. And so I decided to join the other ranks. At the time, this was in 06,
wow.
I committed fully.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was even before that. My son was about one when we caught the nanny stealing. We hired someone to help us, and then
yikes.
and that wasn't good. And so I just said, you know what? I'm just gonna stop auditioning. I'm gonna stay home and see, you know. And so I became a stay-at-home dad. And
how was that transition? I mean, we talk a lot about on the show that like what it is it to be a man and being a stay-at-home dad. How was that transition in your head?
Well, that's a cool question, because, you know, this is when the Tao started to seep out. In fact, I was such a nervous wreck about the state, you know, being a father of two and my wife's business, and we just bought a house. All these real life adult pressures were really on. And so I sought counsel and a psychiatrist I revealed my secret of being a Taoist. And she said, well, listen, sounds like you're going to have to break that out and bring it out of yourself and use it in your, you know, in your dealing with your children. And I guess I hadn't thought of it, but as she was saying it, it made sense. You know, I really treasured it as a secret, but it to
why did you feel like it was a secret?
Well, it wasn't necessarily secret, but it was.
It was your personal thing.
Yeah, but it describes within the philosophy to let people see it. You don't need to talk about it.
Okay.
And so I loved that idea that I didn't. You know, you see people holding up their. You know, people fighting wars in the name of their God. My God is nature. I experience nature, and that's all I really. Mm-hmm. have to do to experience it to its fullest. And that's what it asks me to do, you know? Mm-hmm. And so...
And running was a part of that?
Well, yeah, running... Well, so running in the beginning was sort of competitive. And yet when the Tao made me realize it could be meditational. Mm-hmm. So then all of a sudden, I didn't use a watch anymore. I didn't listen to music. I would always run in nature. And so I listened to my heart and my breathing, like transition from thinking, you're talking about evolving. So transitioning from how fast am I running? What time? What, you know, how far to what is the experience like? So I would run until I was tired, or I would do different types of running. I would run either fast, you know, faster, or slower, or longer. And so, mm-hmm. That's how it affected my running. And how it affected my fathering was that I stopped reading parenting books, essentially, because I kept thinking, this is so hard, there must be answers to these questions. And so I did read a lot of parenting books, and they were informative, but it really boils down to experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what what I tried to do, so what I did is I translated the philosophy of the 81 poems with fathering in mind. Right. So it's written in the traditional style of the Tao Te Ching, 81 verses. And so I took verse number one and I sort of knew it by heart, and I reimagined it, translated it with fathering in mind. How could this help a father?
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that with all the 81 poems, having been, I guess I was by that time, 14 years into being a parent. And so, that's how it's written.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is ESPN LA. I'm LaFern Cusack speaking with artist, actor, and author Gregory Sporleader. He wrote The Tao of Dadding, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Fathers, available for Father's Day on Amazon. Check it out. Now, Greg, when we went over to your house, like years and years ago, when my son was like maybe two or mm-hmm. something, I saw how you were so present and you were teaching him drumming and, you know, how excited he was. And I was like, oh, I want to be like that. I want to, you know, not say, don't touch that. Don't do that. Da, da, da. It's like, oh, come here. Let's, you know, and that's why he's like, Uncle Spoonie, I want Uncle Spoonie to do it.
Well, that's so kind of you to say. And you know, part of it is instinctual. And part of it was that my mom had a nursery school as a kid.
Oh.
So, and I worked with my mom. You know, so as a kid, I was working with kids. And then as a high school and my first 2 years of college, I worked at a summer camp with kids. And, you know, the real secret to it all, and this is a big secret, and I'm willing to share it with the world, is that parents, you know, we're under such great strain and responsibility and pressure constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Remember when they're first born? I mean, it's nonstop. Everything changes. Your time changes. But, you know, I think what really helped me was as an actor, right? As actors, we practice empathy. We're trying mm-hmm. to be other people. Not only are we in other people's shoes, we have to become them.
Yeah.
So I've played killers. So I have to imagine, how can someone kill? How is that? I don't know, but I have to believe it as an actor. I think what happens with parents is we're so overwhelmed, and there's dinner to make, there's laundry to do, there's so many things to do that we want our child to rise up to meet our communication right? As opposed to us being empathetic and imagining, like, they are striving so hard to understand us. Mm-hmm. They're essentially learning language.
Yes.
So imagine if you went to a foreign country that you didn't speak the language and you were being bossed around by mm-hmm. your loved one. So mm-hmm. that's where patience, and so the three treasures of the Tao are patience, simplicity, and compassion. Those three things alone are the three best parenting advice. Just stick with those three.
Mm-hmm.
And the fourth would be balance. So, you know, as I became a stay-at-home dad and my responsibilities lessened work-wise, well, then I had more patience.
Mm-hmm.
Things could be simpler, because when we're rushed, we think, oh my goodness, I only have this amount of time with my kid. It needs to be monumental, especially for dads who work hard and then come home.
Yes.
They want their time with their kids to be precious. But it's their perception of precious mm-hmm. time, not the child's. So if we put ourselves in the child's world, that's why I was telling your husband, did you get the hot glue gun yet? And he's like, what? I said, Bill. And your husband is one of the greatest artists I know, and not only actors, but painters and drawers and builders. Get your kid. Here's another great secret. All your old magazines, scissors and glue. At about 5, get a hot glue gun. Before that, just Elmer's. Cut out and make collages.
Oh,
yeah. Coloring books are okay, but don't think about the end product. Just think creation, creation, creation. Keep them creating. If they'll fall in love with creating and not the end product, right?
Yes.
And that's what we want to happen. So then it's ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, what we do now in art class is, right?
Yeah.
There's a grade. There's the best in class. It's not about process.
Yes.
It's about the end.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and that's one thing we try to practice is stay where your feet are. Stay where your feet are, because like my mentor and Bill's mentor, Bill Burns, who mm-hmm. just recently passed away, that's his key thing was stay where your feet are.
Yeah.
And I'm like, when I do that, I get out of expectations and I get out of outcome and I enjoy the moment.
Result, right.
And then you asked me before we got on air what I like most about, you know, doing the show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I talked about my process, but I also enjoy sharing of myself with the guests and them sharing their experience with me, which I think is so monumental. I think it's just like that's what we're here to do, share of ourselves.
Yeah, yeah. The stories, right? Why aren't we teaching kids stories? I mean, that's how we learned for thousands of – that's the – birth of education is stories, and yet we're, you know, that's how I eventually learned. Once I realized my love for stories is why I became an actor and how I became a reader, that's how I ended up teaching my kids.
So I'm trying to understand how you were able to learn how to read and then...
Well, when the pressure, someone gave me the right book. And suddenly it tapped into my love of story. I mean, the movies we love because we don't – it's very passive. Mm-hmm. You just have to watch and enjoy. Mm-hmm. Reading, you know, you have to use more of your imagination. But you get more out of it, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I get more out of it because you have to work a little bit harder. But it becomes sort of three-dimensional in your imagination. Whereas watching a movie is sort of flat, you know. Mm-hmm. It's exciting. It's apples and oranges. But would you order the same ice cream every time you went to the ice cream shop? No, you need some variety.
Right. And then you passed on that passion to your daughter because you were saying that she is reading some of the books for Harry Potter and spotting things in there.
Yeah, yeah, she's a Harry Potter. Well, what, you know, so my kid, here in L.A., right, you got to drive everywhere. So we never had television or iPhones or anything in the cars when we were driving to school back and forth. And we would,
hello.
And we would, oh,
well,
here's your boy. Hey,
well, hello, David. How are you? Thanks for coming in on the show. I wonder where Daddy is.
Hey,
Daddy is watching baseball on the TV.
Can you go get one of those magic wands for me? We're going to cast a spell for the audience in a minute. Okay? Thanks, buddy. Davey just broke out his magic wands for me. I love, you know. So Harry Potter is a great example of, you know, the power of story. I mean, her story alone. Her story, the story of Harry Potter, right? That rings in so many, rings so loud and true all across the world that that's just so powerful.
Right.
I mean, that's the point I'm trying to make is, so when I would drive my kids around, we would make up stories. We had two separate worlds. By the end, we had two main worlds, Harry Potter top worlds that we would, and as they got older and their vocabulary grew and their ideas grew, I would ask them what should happen next. And so we would make these elaborate stories, almost like The Simpsons, though, where each day something new, you know, the episode would start. One of them was about a Robin Hood character and his buddy. And one of them could talk to the animals, and the other one was strong as all the animals. And they lived in the woods by themselves. And there were some mean kids because yeah. Eventually you got to bring in some conflict because
right.
That's about age six is when they understand conflict and meanness and stuff. And so we would create these elaborate stories. And I tell you, when kids are little, you know, all of that foundational stuff, it kind of goes away for a while at about age six. Then they become fascinated outwardly. And all that comes in, but all the early stuff is down deep in the bones and in the blood. And so even when they're little babies, you know, singing the lullabies and making things up and telling your history and your heritage and where your people are from and how they have persevered. And we can introduce these archetypical situations through people we know, because I tell you what, Disney, God bless them, but they will download imagination right into your kid's brain if you let them, because it is so beautiful and addictive, mm-hmm. and their stories are so compelling. Pixar, please, I could watch that stuff on an endless loop. It's so fascinating. But how are we going to continue to create artists if people don't have personal journeys and personal stories? And so it starts early.
Right.
And I think, you know, again, what this book talks about is it doesn't teach a daddy anything. The Tao is within all of us. And the Tao Te Ching, and what I hope to do is it allows daddies to recognize, wait, this is in me. I do have the power, and I do have the courage, and I do have the wisdom to be a wise daddy.
Mm-hmm. And that you are. Again, the Tao of Daddying, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Fathers. You can get it just in time for Father's Day on Amazon. Get it now. So with your teaching, how have you seen your kids grow and communicate?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. You know, I believe a lot in, you know, sort of, I guess it's reincarnation, you know, that people come with these souls, you know, and it's our duty to allow that soul to evolve. And that's another thing, that we're under so much stress and responsibility that we feel that we have to teach. We want them to be something, when in fact, you know, we have to at least balance enough time for allowing them to become who they're supposed to be. And that sometimes that seems like, oh, well, they're not doing anything. Like, I constantly am harping on my boy for, you know, you could be doing something. You know, I'm doing something. It's called nothing, Dad. You know what you want? I'm like, okay, you're right, you know. And that, what that really is, it means I'm not doing enough, or I should be doing something more than bothering him. So, but it's hard to, I mean, that's why we have vacations, right? You go on vacation to do nothing. Well, I think that, especially with kids, there needs to be some nothing time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We used to walk home from school. Now everyone gets driven to and from school. There were all of these moments where I think, where at least when I was of that age, you had these private moments. And now I think with all the media that's so at everyone's fingertips,
mm-hmm.
why would you think about yourself or your friends or your ancestors when, whoop, you could be watching,
yes.
you know, some... something.
That's interesting. You talk about your ancestors. So this thought has been on my mind for the past couple of days is, you know, our family's been experiencing a lot of death, and just like a lot of families, you know, my parents passed, and, you know, Bill Burns passed, mm-hmm. and, you know, some people are sick, but it's like, what did you learn from them? What legacy are you carrying on from your parents and their parents and their, you know, parents? What legacy, what energy are you carrying on to make this world a better place? I've been thinking about that a lot, and it's like, oh my goodness, I want to be happy, and I want to share that.
Yeah.
You know, I want to share, you know, my dad.
Yeah, yeah.
And what he's done. And
I think we've lost the, and you're doing it, you know, we should practice our stories. I mean, I do. I'm a professional storyteller. Well, I'm more of a puppet, but I'm trying to become a, you know, the actor's the puppet.
Oh.
I've written some screenplays, and I love all, but I think that it's important. I mean, that's the way it used to be. That's the way it's been up until the last 100 years before that. The great storytellers, the theater, you know, you would, lessons taught through stories of whether it was fiction or not. And so I think it's really valuable for us to, you know, some of us are more exciting and better at it than others, but it should be a constant practice, teaching through stories and creating stories. And you know, well, we grew up in Chicago, so improv was so that, and that's something that, you know, to get your kid to participate in a conversation are an imaginative game. We would look at the billboards going to school, you know, and we'd be like, okay, what's that person doing on that billboard? And are you be that person, and I'll be this person at a stoplight. And they'd have conversations between the billboards. You know?
That's cool.
Right. So we were constantly, or we'd see people on the street and give them voices or or tell stories about them or, you know. I was constantly pushing their imagination.
Yes.
With story as the push.
It was, yeah. It was funny. One time I was doing that with a person on the street, and Bill, my husband, was in the car, and I was saying, you know, oh yeah, that person just got back from, you know, the synagogue, and you know, they're going down the street to the dollar store. He's like, you know that person? I was like, Bill, come on, I'm making up a story about this person and their life. Isn't that more exciting than just?
That's so funny. I thought you were going to say he was going to add on to it because he's a master.
Well,
that's what you were expecting, right?
I was expecting
improv, right? Yeah.
Right, but
he was so convincing. Yeah.
He goes, your face is just so sincere. I don't know when you're joking or not. And I'm like, okay, so we're what, 10 years into our marriage, and he's
still not certain. That's pretty.
But it's funny though.
That's exciting.
But when he does catch on. Okay, this one time, this is about sharing. This one time, when we first started sharing, we were out at in Malibu, and we're on the deck, and we're looking at the ocean, and I was like, oh, Bill, a shark, shark! And he looks at me, his face was scrunched up, and he's like, you know that's not a shark, right? And I look at him, I'm like, but isn't it more fun to say shark than dolphin? And he goes, oh, okay. So the next morning we wake up and the dolphins come, and I hear him down in the kitchen going, shark, shark. I go, yes, I finally got him.
I get it, right.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah, he knows how to play along once you give him the rules.
Right, he has to know the rules.
Yeah, yeah. He was a little slow learner, but once he caught on, he was stand back. Yeah.
Right, but that's was him on stage, right?
Yeah.
And that's how you guys worked off of each other, right?
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. Yeah. No doubt, give and take.
Yeah, and you guys were talking about being on stage and you can't create that one moment again, which in life you were saying with the Tao of Dad, and you can't recreate a moment. Can you talk about that a little bit further?
Well, Gregory. I think just always, you know that you're... that each moment has the potential to win an Academy Award, but not in a dramatic sense. You know, not that it has to be that Academy Award is not the right word, but it can be meaningful. You know, my daughter, I'm teaching her to drive, and so last night we drove around. Her younger brother was at the IHOP on a date with some friends. You know, and so we're like, you know, we had an hour, and I said, well, let's just drive around. You haven't practiced driving at the night, and we just drove around for about an hour, listening to music. Listening to Burnin', Bob Marley's, she's really into listening to Bob, and so we're all the great wisdom, and she stops at a stoplight, and she goes, Dad, this is really a special night driving around with you. You know, like, it was so great that she recognized, and I think that that's some of the things that you were talking about earlier, like, how do I think my sort of parent philosophy hasn't manifested yet. In that moment last night, it was like, wow, she realizes that she's in her story, and this is going to be a story point, to use those terms, you know, in her life. Yeah, man, my dad was cool. He let me drive around in the night. We didn't have insurance yet. Yeah, I wasn't insured. And he kept telling me, reminding me that I wasn't insured and to be careful. And it was risky, and, you know.
Yeah.
And so you include them in these moments, and then they become special moments. So I think what happens is when you're under pressure and responsibility, I mean, you want to make a special moment? Disneyland, baby. And this is, I mean, it can't get any more spectacular than that. But if that's, if that becomes the go-to, if that becomes the normal, if that's the most special, right? Again, back to the ice cream store analogy. You got to have as many flavors as you can to entice and excite and communicate with your kid. Right? In the Tao, it talks about moderation, right? Living simply. Well, the best part of living simply is the well-earned splurge, right? So if you live simply, then, you know, I mean, that's how vacations were invented, but the same thing could happen Friday night ice cream party, or, you know, Saturday morning pancakes, or whatever it is. You create these, it's up to you to create the dynamic and make it exciting. It's what the parents make it.
Yeah, we had Sunday morning grand slam breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
We had the pancakes, the bacon.
Grand slam, baby.
Right.
Four things.
The cinnamon rolls. Mm. And I was always pissed that my brother always got the most. Well, he's the oldest. Yeah. I'm like, okay, whatever.
But, always.
But that was what we're recreating with my son now.
Yeah.
The grand slam breakfast.
Yep.
So, Gregory, the author of The Tao of Daddying, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Fathers,
right.
I am speaking properly.
And I really think there is a father revolution happening right now.
I do too.
And that's what kind of gave me the permission, if you will, because, again, I'm not highly educated, and my expertise is in experience. And the book is written from my experience as a father and my love of this ancient philosophy. I know there are scholars out there. I've already been sort of questioned on Facebook of the authenticity of my expertise. And I just quote Lao Tzu, who says, you know, the journey of 1,000 miles starts beneath your feet. And I just started, and it all happened. I mean, the idea that you and I are sitting here talking about this, that's pretty magic, wasn't it?
Yes.
I just called Bill to hang out, and next thing you know, that was 3 weekends ago, and we've hung out for 3 weekends, this being the third weekend. And so.
And it was funny when you were coming in here today, you were saying, wow, I'm coming in to talk about my book and not about my running or basketball.
Yeah.
Or
I'm at ESPN. Like, if you would have told me when I was in Chicago that I would ever be on ESPN, regardless of whatever I was talking about, I wouldn't have believed it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's what you make it. You know,
absolutely.
It's what you believe, and that's part of the philosophy as well, you know.
So what is one of your favorite verses out of your book?
Probably number 44. Yeah.
Now,
it's a good one. You read. I'd love to hear you read it.
Fantasy or reality? Which is more important? Wealth or health? Which is more valuable? Neglect or overindulgence? Which is more destructive? You don't need to convince others. Wise daddies convince only themselves. Interesting.
Right?
Yeah. I know, right? I think we're always thinking of comparison.
Okay, you want to talk about, okay, competitive parenting. That's going to be my next book.
Yeah.
I mean, there probably is one, or there should be one, and it's really a trapping. And we compete with ourselves too, right? Again, I want to be as exciting. I want to be the best I can. Well, it's hard to believe, but being the best and is essentially being there the most.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they remember. That's how they learn the most. That's how they become themselves the most, is when they're not constantly being told what to do. We over-schedule, over-demand, and over.
Mm-hmm.
And then we think they're being lazy when they're finally
overwhelmed
and wore out, you know?
I know.
My boy is growing right now. He's 14. And if he stands still long enough, you could see him grow. And so he needs, you know, they need time to not only grow, but to be quiet and alone and with themselves. And so it's hard for us because we want to make sure they're getting the most they can. Right. And then when we go someplace or we see other parents, especially when they're little, you know, who's got the, you know, the nicest toys and the toys, right? Toys alone.
Oh my goodness, right.
And where your birthday party is and what happens at your competitive birthday party.
I wasn't ready for that.
It's crazy, right?
Right.
Although mine were always, my kids always had the best because I always make these treasure maps. You know, and I'd make them up myself. They were so simple, right? Just a simple treasure
what
map.
What do you do on October 16th?
Well, let me check my schedule.
We need a treasure map.
If it's Davey. Because it's so exciting. Then you become part of it. It's not like, I mean, you could have a jumpy house and an ice cream bar and everyone, you know, and you stand back and watch. Are you participate? Okay, I'm the lead pirate. I'm going to take us on this treasure map. Where's the treasure? You know, we've got to find the treasure map. What's the first clue? Where's the next piece of the map? Where's the next piece? Treasure, you know?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great idea.
Right. The event of it.
And yes.
So back to competitive parenting. I mean, if we could all, I mean, that's how our generation thinks good parenting is because our parents left us alone because that's how parenting was supposed to be.
Go outside and play, you know.
Yeah, out, right? Yeah. Don't come in until the lights, street lights come on. Right. And to our generation, we think that's neglect or abuse. You know, and now we put helmets on and gloves on and pads on and we stand next to the bike, you know, and we, you know, whereas the most valuable things I remember learning as a kid, they were all on my own, secretly, privately, whether it's good or bad. You know, I was set free.
Oh.
And we need to, and if you do the research too, you know, crime and all these horrible things that we think might happen. Numbers are exactly the same.
Yeah.
Almost identical. I mean, school shootings, not.
Oh.
Guns, not. But all the other panicky stuff that parents worry about, things are pretty much the same statistically mm-hmm. as when we were kids. So we should find ways of letting our kids be more free.
Yeah. There was a woman who was saying that this young boy at school had, you know, soccer practice in the morning or some sort of athletic thing. Then he had school. Then he had practice. Then he had Spanish class. Then he had violin class. And then he started going a little bit, you know, cuckoo, like he was overwhelmed. So they sent him to a psychiatrist and the psychiatrist says, well, he's doing a lot. He needs to relax. So guess what they did? They put him in a yoga class. Oh. And it was like another class.
I know. Oh, well, I thought you were going to say they put them on Ritalin because I mean, in 100 years, they're going to say, you know, they did it the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm.
They thought more when it was actually less, right? There's the old expression, less is more. It seems hard to believe, but mm-hmm. kick your kid in the backyard and say, don't come, I don't care. And, you know, dig,
yes.
build, make, pretend, build something.
And this from your book, Gregory, if your kids, again, with 44, verse 44, if your kids' desire for stuff is their happiness, they will never be happy. Teach them to be happy with what they have. When they realize they have enough, they will be truly rich. When a child craves things more than love, you have work to do. Happiness comes from how it's done. When you manifest this, you can make the whole world happy. We're trying to teach Davey that.
He's at that age where he wants.
Yes.
Yeah.
He wants.
Well, you know what he wants? Right, so it's doing. It's like what we learned in acting class, you know, the doing of something. Mm-hmm. So when you get on stage, you need something to do to help tell the story along. So kids really want something to do. That's why if you can have the hard part is dealing with the mess of it, you know, right? But if a kid can make a mess, like kids should be able to, they have to make a mess.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can have a little mess table, that's what we always say. We had an art table and it was a free for all.
Mm-hmm.
Anything on the table. We had these two drawers with all the stuff in it. Get it out. Get the, you know, let's work on this. And we mm-hmm. had three or four things. I always had a bag of clay. None of it ever manifested. You know, some things became masterpieces. Most of it was just process, right? And what we would do, so mommy would be at work all week. And we would make things. And then on Friday night, she'd come home and we'd play art gallery. So whatever we made during the week, we did this three or four times. we'd call mom and say, art gallery tonight. And so that means stop at the cash station, because she would buy. Like, we never paid our kids to do chores. We only bought their artwork.
Wow.
And so we would set up whatever they made as art gallery. And then we would get kind of dressed up, and mommy would come home. We'd be like, welcome to the art gallery. I'm like, look at what I made. Look at what I made. $5. And they would, my wife would, she would, you know, we would bid and buy things. And that's how they would get their treat money, was by creating.
That's so cool.
And so, and you know, and part of making a mess is cleaning up. You know, kids don't know how to do things until they're taught, and it's easier to teach them things, you know, if it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So, all right, let's start this project. We're making the project. Okay, now it's time to clean up the project. Mm-hmm. And that's a complete, you know, that's a complete story, you know.
Gregory, what was the most difficult thing that you had to go through getting to the Tao of dadding and accepting being a stay-at-home dad?
Well, this is really a manifestation of my, you know, I don't float on any cloud. I mean, I deal with depression. I deal with anxiety. I deal with unemployment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I am being a very sensitive person. All the typical issues that grown men have, I have to the nth degree. And so I needed something to help me more than, you know, I sought help from counsel, from a psychiatrist and from friends and all. But, you know, when you can have something internally your own, that I found was the most helpful. And so the hardest part was mostly the uncertainty, which is, of course, vulnerability. We are all going to die. The world is dangerous as it is beautiful. And so, in what the Tao really, if there was one word to describe the Tao, and essentially the symbol of the Tao is the yin yang, which represents balance. So if we think about parenting, if we balance our parenting, just communicating with our kids in a balanced way, again, back to what we talked about earlier, like instead of just talking to your kid, spending as much time listening as the child as you do talking to the child. Balance those two things. Okay, oh my God. Like, I'll catch myself all the time going, oh my God, that was a soliloquy. And all I need to do is take out the trash.
Right?
I'm not imagining, oh look, he's, you know, he's dirty, he's hungry, he wants to take a shower, you know. Let him take. Will you promise to take the trash out after your shower? Promise, promise, pinky promise? Good, go, shower. So again, back to balancing. Mm-hmm. That became the key, was realizing that I could use these principles to overcome this sense of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, they could be hit by a car. They could be all the horrible things that we wake us up in the middle of the night.
The man with the machete gonna get to me.
Exactly, machete man.
Oh my God.
You know, it's all we all have those fears, and
yes,
and so that was probably it, out of a state of, you know, sheer vulnerability. And the best advice for vulnerability is to accept it. Oh my gosh. I'm the father. Yes, I have all these responsibilities, but I can only do as much as I can do. And worrying about it only makes it worse. So I'm going to just accept.
Yes.
Be simple, patient, compassionate toward myself, toward others, find that balance, and try to have as much calm joy as I can.
Yes. Mr. Gregory Sporleader, actor, author, artist, the author of The Tao of Dadding, Ancient Wisdom for Modern Fathers. You could get it on Amazon. And also, we're going to be at Peddler's Fork in Calabasas this coming Saturday, June 9th, from 10 a.m. to 12. You could get your signed copy there. Greg is going to be there to answer questions, and we're going to do a little interview, and
cool.
It's going to be a great conversation.
It's going to be exciting. Let me just say one last thing also. You know, I have a website, thedaoofdadding.com, and I'm really, really hoping that the overall goal of all this is to start a tribe of wise daddies. Like, all daddies have wisdom, right? And what if we could create a space, you know, online, and then maybe groups or whatever, where dads could share their wisdom? Because there's not a lot of, you know, we talk about sports bring men together in a great way, right? And we relish in the joy of competition, but there's that feeling can also be, we can also have that in our parenting. But it's non-competitive, so that's where the dads have trouble. Like, well, there's no winner or loser. Well, no, but there's the joy of parenting. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we all sort of – and that's what's so great about wisdom, you know, that it's ancient. So that you can say, oh, man, my kid did this. He accomplished this stage in life. Isn't that – oh, it reminds me of when my kid did that. You know, mm-hmm. Oh, he's learning to drive. You know, all these stages, all mm-hmm. these story points in their lives – we can share the wisdom of that together so that we can, you know, really embrace the joy of fathering instead of the fear. You're like, you know,
the fear of it, right?
The fear of living in, right, you know, the anxiety of it. Because that's the only way to, what I'm trying to say is to fight the anxiety and pain. The best way to do it, our fear, is through, you know, joy and community.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that is very important. Again, the community of it all is when you come and share, you know, just like we were saying, the stories that you guys have with, you know, what you're dealing with, you may not know that someone else is dealing with it too. And then you guys.
Yeah, it really is helpful. I just had a guy who got my book, and he said the nicest thing. He said, you know, I'm so grateful that you wrote this, because there are times where I feel like I'm bragging about my daughter so much because I'm so proud of her and I love her so much. He said, I'm so grateful that you did this. I mean, mm-hmm. that's horrible that a man feels embarrassed to be so proud of his kid, when that's what we should be really. They are our champions. I mean, so are the Lakers and the Bulls, but equally we should be able to champion our kids for not only their greatness, but their beings.
Yes.
Not just the great things they do, but just who they are, who they become. And we need uncles and friends and neighbors and everyone. Again, the tribal thing, you know. I'm telling you, man, if the men really come together as a tribe, we could solve this masculinity issue, which I think haunts the world, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's up to us.
Yes. Well, I thank you so much for sharing the Tao of Dadding, Mr. Gregory Sporleader. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
I'm LaFerne Cusack. This is ESPN LA 710.
ESPN LA 710.